Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
The fact that the Trump campaign clearly wanted to run against Joe Biden tells me everything I need to know about what they fear in Kamala Harris.
Alaska Democrats quickly rally support around Kamala Harris after President Joe Biden ends his bid for re-election. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 22nd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, what will the Supreme Court's rollback of the Chevron deference mean for Alaska fisheries?
The onus is really now on Congress to be more specific in what they want the agencies to do.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's delegation to the Democratic National Convention endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris in the wake of Joe Biden's announcement Sunday that he would drop out of the 2024 presidential race. Party officials met Sunday evening and coalesced behind Harris, according to a news release from the Alaska Democratic Party. Democratic Anchorage State Representative Andy Josephson, one of 20 voting delegates, says it's bittersweet. Josephson says he's proud of Biden's record, but he says Harris has a better shot to, quote, reinvigorate the Obama coalition and defeat Donald Trump.
I think Kamala Harris will do a better job of making the argument and presenting the case against Donald Trump. And the fact that the Trump campaign clearly wanted to run against Joe Biden tells me everything I need to know about what they fear in Kamala Harris.
Josephson says the decision to endorse Harris was unanimous among those who attended the Sunday evening meeting. Delegate Ron Meehan commended Biden's decision to step aside.
I know that decision was one that was incredibly difficult for President Biden to make, but one that further demonstrates his commitment to the country, above all else, to doing what's right.
Meehan said he was optimistic that Harris could run on the Biden administration's policy record, pointing to investments in infrastructure and the fight against climate change. Fellow delegate Mike Davis says some floated waiting a day or two before moving to endorse Harris, but Davis says the consensus was for quick action.
I think that the people felt like, hey, this needs to happen now. It's important that she knows from the get-go that she has the support of Alaska delegation, and so that was the prevailing argument versus let's wait a day here.
Republican U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski said in a social media post that she, quote, respects President Biden's decision to act in the best interest of the country by stepping aside in the 2024 presidential election. The other two members of Alaska's congressional delegation, Republican Senator Dan Sullivan and Democratic Congresswoman Mary Peltola, had yet to comment on the news as of midday today. Democrats around the country have rallied behind Harris, including some who had been floated as possible competitors. State Democratic parties in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Kentucky, among others, also endorsed Harris shortly after Biden's announcement. An Anchorage Superior Court judge on Friday disqualified 27 signature books filled out by Alaskans hoping to repeal Alaska's ranked choice voting system, leaving it unclear whether the issue has enough support to advance to a November vote. The Alaska Beacon reports that in a 95-page order analyzing allegations that signature gatherers violated state law while gathering support for the repeal measure, Judge Christina Rankin said the Alaska Division of Elections must recount the signature totals by Wednesday. State law requires petitioners to obtain a certain number of signatures statewide, but even though the disqualified signature books contain nearly 3,000 signatures, there isn't any danger of missing that threshold. What's uncertain is whether the disqualified signatures will cause supporters to miss a separate mandatory threshold that requires a certain number of signatures from at least 30 of 40 state house districts. Before the ruling, backers had sufficient signatures in 34 districts. Former Alaska Attorney General Kevin Clarkson represented repeal supporters in the case and said that by his preliminary count, backers will lose only one district when the new count takes place. Regardless of this week's count, an appeal to the Alaska Supreme Court is expected. A recent U.S. Supreme Court decision could have important implications for fisheries in Alaska. Last month, the Supreme Court overturned a legal principle called Chevron deference. For 40 years, that principle gave federal agencies wide authority to interpret the gray area in laws passed by Congress. Now, more of that authority will go to judges. The decision came after a legal battle over who should pay for bycatch monitors on trawl boats. The potential effects extend to all federally regulated industries. But KDLG's Meg Duff looks at the impact on fisheries in particular.
Many trawl boats are required to have bycatch observers on board. And in Alaska, the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council can have trawl boats pay for those observers. That's the law. It's spelled out in the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which governs commercial fishing. But that act is not clear on who should pay for bycatch observers elsewhere. In the Atlantic, a federal agency created a similar funding program, and a trawling business sued. Anna Creary is an environmental lawyer in Anchorage. She's been watching that court case.
And so NIMS used its agency authority to interpret the statute and fill in the gap and say, we're going to do what we do in the North Pacific region here in the Atlantic region. And the court said, nope, you can't do that.
That Supreme Court decision in a case known as Loper-Bright was a reversal. 40 years ago, in an environmental lawsuit called Chevron versus Natural Resource Defense Council, the Supreme Court established a legal doctrine known as Chevron deference. That doctrine said that when federal laws are vague, federal agencies should fill in the gaps, and courts should defer to the expertise of those agencies. Creary says that understanding of agency power has become a baseline assumption.
The administrative law, you know, unbeknownst to many people, really forms the backbone of what we just perceive as, like, you know, our everyday life, like modern society, right? But the extent to which this decision destabilizes that, I think is quite profound.
Now, legal analysts say it will be easier to challenge federal agency decisions and to win. Creary says that challenges could play out in the agencies that set safety standards for everything from drugs to airplanes. It could also make regulations by the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council or the National Marine Fisheries Service easier to challenge. In Alaska, questions about how much power federal agencies have are important for all sorts of projects that could impact salmon habitat. Siobhan McIntyre is a lawyer at Trustees for Alaska, whose work includes lawsuits opposing Pebble Mine, which many Bristol Bay fishermen see as a threat to salmon.
If, for example, we're in a plaintiff's posture and holding agencies accountable, the overturning of deference to agencies could be positive for our clients. On the other hand, if we're in a defensive posture seeking to uphold an agency action, then the opposite could be true.
McIntyre says it's too soon to say what impact last month's Supreme Court rulings will have on Pebble Mine or on other lawsuits. Under the Dunleavy administration, the state of Alaska has been fighting a number of federal agency decisions, including a decision by the Environmental Protection Agency to block Pebble Mine. Commissioner John Boyle, a Dunleavy appointee, leads Alaska's Department of Natural Resources. He says they are starting to look at what the ruling could mean for a variety of legal challenges.
And we can really look at that in the context of looking at environmental laws that have been passed, the Endangered Species Protection Act, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, et cetera, et cetera. The onus is really now on Congress to be more specific in what they want the agencies to do.
Boyle says Loper-Bright might reinvigorate the state's effort to limit which streams and lakes are subject to federal wetland protection under the Clean Water Act. That's the law the EPA used to block Pebble Mine. In Dillingham, I'm Meg Duff.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a nonprofit is expanding the protected wetlands at Potter Marsh in Anchorage.
The wildlife that relies on Potter Marsh that migrates through every year and all the visitors who love watching that, we depend on that marsh staying healthy.
That's ahead. Stay with us. A Haines man and a couple flying from Juneau to Yakutat are missing after their plane never arrived at its destination over the weekend. According to the Chilkat Valley News, the U.S. Coast Guard says the owner and operator of the missing 1948 Beechcraft Bonanza is Samuel Wright of Haines. Wright was flying two passengers, Hans Munich and Tanya Hutchins, to their home in Yakutat on Saturday, but the plane never made it. The Coast Guard, Alaska Rescue Coordination Center, Civil Air Patrol, and Alaska State Troopers are entering their third day of searching for signs of the missing plane in the Fairweather Mountain Range. Troopers said in a dispatch yesterday that they got a report that the plane went missing near Mount Krillion, which is at the southern end of the range. Munich and Hutchins own Coastal Air Service, formerly Yakutat Coastal Airlines, where Munich has been flying for decades. According to the National Weather Service, showers and heavy rain are expected to move into the search region, reducing visibility and bringing wind gusts and lower cloud ceilings this evening. A search is also ongoing for a boater on the Yukon River. According to an Alaska State Trooper dispatch, they were notified Saturday that Robert Peter was overdue traveling from Circle to Fort Yukon. It says that aircraft and boats are involved in the search effort, which includes troopers, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service law enforcement officers, and area residents. Anyone with information about Peter's whereabouts is asked to contact troopers in Fairbanks. A search continued yesterday on the Chena River in downtown Fairbanks, where a man went missing in the water Friday. KUAC's Robin reports.
With prayers and Gwich'in singing, the family of Ilya Asegnok gathered Sunday morning to resume searching for his body in the Chena River. Ilya's uncle, David Solomon of Copper Center, led the family members in song. As Fairbanks City Police and Alaska State Troopers launched three boats Sunday morning at Grail Landing to dredge the river below the pedestrian bridge where Asegnok went into the river. At about 2 o'clock Friday afternoon, the Fairbanks Fire Department received a report that a man jumped or fell off the Chena River pedestrian bridge and was seen briefly struggling in the water. Since then, searchers with the Tanana Chiefs Conference, the City of Fairbanks Police and Fire Departments, University Police, and Fish and Wildlife Troopers have been dragging the river. Asegnok's family, including some who traveled in from Fort Yukon and elsewhere around the region, have been standing vigil under canopies in the park at Grail Landing. Solomon said the family is providing sandwiches and drinks for the searchers and accepting donations of gasoline and oil for the boats, as well as food, paper plates, cups, and plasticware. This is the second tragedy for the Asegnok family in 2 months. June 17th, older brother Andrew Asegnok drowned in the Yukon River near Fort Yukon. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
A grand jury has indicted an Anchorage doctor and her husband in a case that allegedly involved deceiving patients about the drugs being injected into their bodies. That's according to an indictment handed up in federal court last week against rheumatologist Claribel Tan and her husband Daniel Tan, charging them with health care fraud and tax evasion. Federal prosecutors with the Alaska U.S. Attorney's Office said in a statement today that the couple tricked patients about the necessity of certain medications, filed false insurance claims for medication and medical services, and included false information in tax filings in 2014, 2015, and 2017. Neither the indictment nor prosecutors said what medication or medications were deceptively injected. The prosecutors alleged the Tans illegally obtained more than $10 million. Through separate civil action, the U.S. Justice Department has seized about $8.5 million from the Tans, according to the statement from the U.S. Attorney's Office. Court records show the Tans were both arrested today. A new study on hatchery pink salmon shows that some stray fish mingle with wild stocks and could alter the timing of wild runs. And that could lead to less productive runs in the future. As Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports, the study is part of a decade-long effort to understand the pros and cons of Alaska's hatchery industry.
Peter Westley grew up fishing for salmon in Prince William Sound.
Some of my fondest memories are actually spending time fishing in front of Wally Nuremberg Hatchery and other things, so I've been tied to hatcheries in one way or another for a really long time.
Now, he's a salmon researcher at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, looking at how hatchery and wild fish interact. He's one of a dozen authors of a study focusing on years of data on pink salmon hatcheries in Prince William Sound. It was funded through universities in Alaska, Washington, and Oregon, and supported by hatchery operators, the state's Fish and Game Department, and nonprofit science groups. They all want to know more about salmon.
What are some of the potential trade-offs regarding the use of hatchery fish as a part of the fabric of Alaska's fisheries?
Salmon hatcheries are a huge part of Alaska's fishing economy. Over two dozen of them provide harvests for thousands of commercial fishermen and are worth over $500 million each year. The state owns some of the hatcheries, which are mostly managed by private nonprofits. They carefully rear salmon eggs and then release the fry at specific sites along the coast. Their hatchery stocks originally came from wild local fish runs. But what happens when the hatchery fish join the wild stocks? They're known as strays.
Individuals that are showing up to the wild population, interbreeding with those wild fish.
Samuel May is another author of the study. He's a research geneticist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and worked with the University of Alaska Fairbanks on modeling for the study. He and other researchers found that some hatchery salmon are straying from their groups and mixing with wild stocks. They're traveling with the wild salmon to spawning grounds and creating a larger overall population, but at the same time, potentially changing the traits of the wild fish. He says there aren't many stray hatchery pinks, roughly 1 to 5% of the population, but that could still make a difference, especially in streams with just a small run of wild fish. And that's because of run timing, a trait that's deeply ingrained in the salmon's genetics.
Pink salmon in particular are probably the strictest timing of all of the different salmon species. They have this really strict 2-year life cycle, and they actually return to the stream in which they were born within just a few days, generally, of when their parents returned.
Hatcheries release juvenile salmon at different times and locations in nearby wild runs to keep the stocks separate. But May says some still mix. This can cause wild populations to increase, which could be a good thing for harvesters. But the hatchery fish can also cause the wild stocks to change the timing of their routine. And timing is everything. Wild salmon have evolved to return during the best temperatures and food availability for their juveniles when they hatch.
They can end up pulling the wild population off of that optimum and changing the dynamics of the wild system. And the fear is that this is going to reduce the population's productivity or resilience to future changes.
Conditions change from stream to stream, and specific salmon runs have adapted to them for thousands of years.
And so if that timing changes just a little bit, then the population as a whole could be at risk of kind of missing the ideal environmental conditions that they need in order to go on and produce that next generation.
As for why salmon occasionally stray, that's unknown and would take more research. But Wesley says what they've learned from this study is still important, that some hatchery and wild salmon mix and create larger populations, which can be a good thing, but it can also potentially change those wild stocks forever.
It is a blessing and a curse, double-edged sword, whatever you want to call it.
The authors say this hatchery pink study doesn't end here. The methods can also be used for hatchery chum salmon in Southeast, which is another multi-million dollar industry in Alaska's fisheries. Reporting for Coast Alaska in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Hot and dry weather has increased wildfire activity. State Division of Forestry and Fire Protection Information Officer Sam Harrell says smoke jumpers, helicopter crews, and water scooping planes responded to two new fires yesterday.
The Teedrinjek Fire west of Venati, and then outside of Tanacross, just west of Mansfield Lake, the Glen Man Lake Fire. And Mansfield Lake is kind of developed with recreation cabins and some year-round homes, in addition to quite a few native allotments. So that's in a full response area, as is the fire up west of Venati, native allotments in the area, the village of Venati.
Meanwhile, Harrell says some firefighters are keeping tabs on wildfires that began earlier this summer and showed new life over the weekend. They include the Main Fire southwest of the village of Ruby, the Grapefruit Complex fires along the Elliott Highway north of Fairbanks, the McDonald Fire southeast of Fairbanks, the Gold King Creek Fire southwest of town, and the Riley Fire near the entrance to Denali National Park. Harrell says drones are helping to target suppression efforts on the Riley and Gold King Creek fires.
The drone operators are monitoring the fire and keeping an eye out for hot spots that occur, and then the firefighters will extinguish those.
Harrell says state and federal wildfire managers are maintaining response resources, including 4 water scooping planes and numerous helicopters to deal with the uptick in activity caused by the heat wave. But he notes that the current fire-prone conditions are not expected to last.
The weather's going to change midweek. The high ridge over the state's going to break down. low pressure from the Bering Sea is going to move back in over the mainland, and it's going to bring with it that southwest flow of very moist air, and that's almost putting a fork in the fire season when that southwest flow starts to set up this time of year.
Harrell says the forecast, combined with a lot of fire activity in Canada in the lower 48, has resulted in some response resources, including two air retardant tankers and nearly 150 firefighters being sent outside.
The Division of Forestry and Fire Protection Pioneer Peak Hotshot crew, they've gone to Alberta. DOF's Gannett Glacier crew, they're in Oregon. The BLM Alaska Fire Service has sent three of their contract crews down to the lower 48, along with the Midnight Sun's hotshot crew.
Harrell says Alaska's incident management team is headed out this week to work the Falls Fire near Burns, Oregon. A statewide nonprofit announced earlier this month that its Anchorage boutique will close to the general public in August. Beacon Hill provides support and resources for youth and families who are at risk of entering foster care or are already in the system. Their boutique, called Beacon Hill Bargain Boutique, is a thrift store that sells secondhand clothes, furniture, and toys for low prices. Kristen Bierma is the executive director for Beacon Hill. She says there's been an increased need by all families for more tangible items like clothing and household goods. She says the shift will allow the nonprofit to direct more resources to the families they serve.
What we were finding is that being open to the public on a regular basis, while it brought in lots of shoppers and great donations and some funding, it really took a lot of resources to stay open to the public.
There are around 3,000 children in foster care each month in Alaska. Whatever families need, Bierma hopes Beacon Hill can help fill the gap. She says the shift in structure will allow clients to feel more comfortable and to shop with dignity.
We believe that this work can't be done without community support and that it takes all of us to serve and support and encourage these kids in foster care or at risk.
Families need to be in contact with an agency to receive services. Boutique donations will still be accepted Tuesday through Friday. Well, with its winding boardwalks through grassy wetlands, Potter Marsh has long been a beloved park in South Anchorage for tourists and Alaskans alike. Now, a nonprofit is taking a step towards protecting the area further by expanding the park by 300 acres. Alaska Public Media's Anissa Vitsa went to visit and has this story.
Ellen Kazeri stands on the boardwalk of Potter Marsh, looking out on the vast field of wetlands.
You can actually see the fish jumping out of the water right now, which is fabulous.
She's the executive director of Great Land Trust.
They're teeny tiny. You're just seeing like a little white or silver flash.
And for 30 years, the nonprofit she leads has dreamed of protecting the land adjacent to Potter Marsh. Now, they're finalizing a deal to purchase that land and transfer it to the city for public use. Kazeri says this means more places for picnicking, hiking, and cross-country skiing. But maybe most important, it will preserve a crucial part of the ecosystem, including the fish she's watching right now.
This is part of what we get to do, is protect the water that's feeding all of this, making it possible to have such a great, full-functioning ecosystem.
The new property contains a network of creeks and small streams that feed into the south end of Potter Marsh. They're really important.
If that water source were cut off, Potter Marsh would basically become a cesspool because there's no new fresh water coming into it. The wildlife that relies on Potter Marsh, that migrates through every year, and all the visitors who love watching that, we depend on that marsh staying healthy.
Great Land Trust has spent years securing over $6 million to buy 200 acres of the land from telecommunications company GCI. The trust is working on raising the final half million. And the city will also add 100 acres from the Heritage Land Bank. Together, those 300 acres are home to more than just fish. Ann Rappaport, president of the Rabbit Creek Community Council, lives right next to the property. She has seen moose, bears, lynx, porcupines, one wolf, and lots of migratory birds.
This is really the last bit of open space that goes from sea level basically to tundra. So there's tremendous wildlife movements here.
When Rappaport's children were young, they would regularly use the area, even though it wasn't technically public land. There's a great hill for sledding, over a mile long, perfect for her daughter's February birthday.
Every year she used to have a birthday party where we'd come sledding down the hill.
Rappaport says over the past 39 years that she's lived in the neighborhood, multiple developers have considered building housing on the land. So she's grateful that it will be preserved for others to explore in the future. And Kazari says that people like Rappaport, who have long used the area, have made it easier to turn it into a park.
The next step will be working with the community and the municipality of Anchorage on a master plan for what the park can look like into the future. It's just nice because we have the breathing room that doesn't have to happen immediately.
Kazari says the new property will be able to open to the public as soon as the purchase is finalized. She thinks this will happen by the end of January, and she says she's excited for people to see just a little bit more of what's right in Anchorage's backyard. At Potter Marsh, I'm Anissa Vitsa.
And finally, tonight, a correction to a story Friday about an Anchorage homeless shelter operator that incorrectly paraphrased Assembly Chair Chris Constant. Constant says a final version of an investigation report about the shelter operator's leaked text messages will be public, but the draft version will not. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Meg Duff in Dillingham, Dan Bross and Robin in Fairbanks, Angela Denning in Petersburg, and Ava White and Anissa Vitsa in Anchorage. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Tim Rocky's our producer. Thanks to Wesley Early for filling in last week. I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.